This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You can add a new entry to the growing list of TV news magazines. It's called Day One, and it premieres this Sunday evening on ABC. The anchor is Forrest Sawyer, so we thought we'd use the occasion to invite him to talk with us about his career in journalism. Sawyer often substitutes for Ted Koppel on Nightline. He reported from the Middle East for 8 months. During the Gulf War, he broke the Pentagon's policy on pool reporting and traveled independently with his crew and satellite dish. Sawyer started his network career at CBS, where he hosted a morning show with Maria Shriver. One of the reporters on Sawyer's new program is former NPR reporter and host John Hockenberry. I asked Forrest Sawyer what he hopes will separate his new program from the other news magazines.
Everyone keeps asking what's different about this program because news magazines are proliferating so much on television. And the answer is we're not going to reinvent the wheel, but we are trying to create a little different form. The first piece, for instance, in the very first program is going to be 32 minutes without commercials. That's quite unusual for a news magazine. Most of them are 11 minutes, 11 minutes, 11 minutes, and Andy Rooney. So we're going to expand the form. We're playing with editing, and we're fiddling around with some of the subject matter as well. So it'll, I think, be a little edgier and put together a little differently.
You've recently been exposed to two very different kinds of pressures, the pressure of war reporting and the pressure of starting a new show. With one, your life is at stake. With the other, your career is on the line. Do those two pressures get to you in different ways?
I sort of like the former and try not to think about the latter.
you like your life being on the line?
Actually, I kind of do. I know that sounds odd, but I am of that weird breed that likes to go into those dicey situations and find it enjoyable, because as you get closer out to the edge there, as you're driving into Kuwait City ahead of the American forces and there's nothing but Iraqis and scared Kuwaitis up ahead of you, things get clearer. People don't lie out there on the edges. They don't have time. And a certain sort of endorphin rush, I suppose, begins to kick in. So I do like that a lot. The career stuff, I don't like at all.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you a little bit about your work on Nightline. What's the typical day like when you're anchoring?
Not as hectic as you might imagine, unless it's a breaking story. If it is an ordinary day, it starts about 11 o'clock in the morning with batting around two or three stories that are hanging up in the air. Then people that are called bookers, body snatchers as they're euphemistically called in the business, go out and try to round up some guests to talk about the topic. You have a brace of people who are crashing together a story that'll run about 8 minutes at the very top of the broadcast. And what I am doing is studying for a final exam.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to like a lot of material on something and just go through it and go through it and go through it and go through it. And then finally, when I get there, I throw it all away so that I actually listen to what the person is saying rather than trying to read a list of questions or something like that. And then you do a little writing going into the program.
How would you describe your approach to getting people to tell you the truth when you're interviewing them on Nightline? Do you think that your style is different from Ted Koppel's?
I think probably it's different. Ted is perhaps a little more confrontational than I am. You're doing live television, and at the end of the day, it really comes down to 2 6-minute segments. That's all it is. It appears to be a half hour, but when you're finally talking about just the interviewing itself, you have one or two or three people in 2 6-minute segments. So you have to go straight for the jugular. You can't waste time circling around, building up, trying to do what you might do if it was a taped interview. And you set the parameters, and you operate in a little bit like a lion tamer when there are several people going at each other's throats.
What was it like the first night you anchored Nightline? Were you nervous about it?
Scared to death. Scared to death. One of the earliest shows, a wonderful ABC News producer named Rick Kaplan, who now produces Primetime, who came to me only a month after I had been at ABC and said, come on over and do Nightline. I said, you really can't do this to me. I'm scared. I can't. He said, that's all right. We'll book flights to 4 different locations under assumed names for you the next morning. You're going to be all right. And I shortly thereafter did a program on the Cuban Missile Crisis. And to show how good Rick was as a producer, they did this tape. And we had Mr. Khrushchev's son and the son of somebody else from Moscow. And I went to Mr. Khrushchev's son, and he had trouble speaking English. He began talking in Russian back to me. So I said, well, I'm hurting here, but I'll go over to the next guy. And I asked him a question, and unfortunately, he stuttered. So if I hadn't had Robert McNamara there, and all you have to do is say, Mr. McNamara, can you give me the history of the Cuban Missile Crisis? I'm going out for donuts. I would have been in terrible trouble. But Rick was able to cut that together and actually make it look like I wasn't a complete fool.
My guest is Forrest Sawyer, and he anchors a new ABC News magazine called Day One that begins this Sunday evening. Many people singled you out for outstanding reporting during the Gulf War. Did you volunteer for the assignment?
Did more than volunteer for the assignment. I was a tremendous troublemaker over there. I hated the pool system. If you remember, the pool system was the way the military would round people up and allow them to go where they wanted them to go, and they'd pack a little field lunch for you, and it was like going on a school trip. Take you to the library, and you get to talk to the people they wanted to talk to and bring you back. And I thought that that wasn't news, that was public relations, and wanted to go out on my own. Unfortunately, Bob Simon and his crew had gotten picked up by the Iraqis at one point, and so everybody became very nervous about letting us go out on freelance runs or without the representation of the military there. You were subject to being arrested if you went beyond 100 kilometers. But I was rabble-rousing and saying, you know, we got to go, we got to go, we got to go. And finally, in fact, Ted Koppel lobbied to allow me to go for his broadcast, and we put on chocolate chips, those camouflage outfits that they wore in the desert, so that mm-hmm. we had a vague appearance like soldiers, and we sneaked through the checkpoints. I had managed to map all the checkpoints, and finally made it to the front and got some interesting pictures and first pictures of deserters and those kinds of things, which proved that it could be done and set the ground for us to be able to go out with a satellite.
How did you sneak through the checkpoints?
Kind of with attitude, just sheer attitude. I'd put on my my military hat and kind of wave through and act like I was in a rush and had somewhere to go, and we had a sand-colored truck, and just bluffed our way through. They could have stopped us at any point, and we'd wound up in the brig.
So you were passing yourself off as a military man?
I was not. I never said I was in the military.
No, but with the attitude you were giving was a military attitude.
Well, the attitude I was giving was that I was in a rush to get somewhere.
Right,
now,
okay.
If the military are in a rush, that's not my fault.
So these were American checkpoints?
Only a couple had American there. Happily, most of them were Saudis.
Mm-hmm.
And the Saudis thought that if they saw an American dressed like that with attitude, he must be in the military.
Yeah, because I'd imagine if there were American checkpoints, people would say, hey, there goes Forrest Sawyer. I mean, that's a problem you could really run into when you're trying to slip unnoticed and you're actually very well known in the country that you're from.
Well, not with sunglasses and a three-day-old beard.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to look more like Robin Williams after a couple of bad nights.
So your editors at ABC finally supported you in breaking away from the press pool?
They did, and we went out and got what I think was a terrific story, which was the first television report from the front itself. And the first pictures of the actual air bombing that was going on and some Iraqi deserters, just by sheer happenstance, drove up to the earth berm where we were situated, right on the front, and gave themselves up in front of our camera. It was just sheer luck. And so when we went back with that story, we had a lot more opportunities to go out on things like I went out with the Saudis in an F-15 on a bombing run and just operated entirely outside the auspices of the U.S. military.
Were there any guidelines that you followed for traveling independently and trying to keep safe?
It's real tricky because you can get into all sorts of situations. The only guideline that I would follow, I was traveling with my satellite dish during the actual ground war. I was traveling with six people, and I would have meetings, basically. I'd pull them all together, the satellite guys and my crew and a producer. And I'd say, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to literally drive into Kuwait City, and it's going to be dark, and there are going to be Iraqis there, and it could be unpleasant. Anybody who doesn't want to go doesn't have to go. And I would lay out the risks involved, and there's simply risks. You can't get around that.
What were the risks that you laid out?
That we could get killed, that the Iraqis might grab us and throw us in prison, or they might shoot us, or they might steal our truck and leave us out in the desert, or we might even run into friendly fire. I mean, we were running out there by ourselves. And what we actually ran into in Kuwait City, by sheer luck, I mean, most of this is luck, as we were driving around the city late at night and passed a number of Iraqis who were trying to wave our truck down so they could grab it and make a run for them, a white Mercedes stopped and right in front of us, two guys with submachine guns got out and said, "Are you with the Americans that I just brought in?" And I said, "Excuse me?" And he turned out to be from the Kuwaiti resistance and put us up at his house and wired us right into the Kuwaiti resistance. So within a matter of 2 hours of getting into Kuwait City, I knew everything that had been happening there from the Kuwaiti side.
And I guess that's the kind of serendipity that helps so much in a dangerous and unsure situation.
It's luck and opportunity,
mm-hmm.
those two things, and you know, chutzpah at some point.
Yeah. What was your timing? When did you decide this is the moment for us to try to get into Kuwait?
Well, I had originally decided that I thought the war was going to last longer than it did. I thought it was going to be at least a week, and I thought gas would be used. Gas could be delivered by artillery, probably not by Scuds, so Scuds didn't bother me. But if you went to the front and you were facing artillery shells, then there could be some problems. So I went around way to the west with the Arab forces where I thought there would be strong fighting. Instead, everybody gave up. They just started pouring in. It was a very surreal scene, walking in this cloud of smoke, dropping their weapons and their gas masks and holding their arms up and saying, "Please give us food." And it became very clear that we had to get to Kuwait City fast. And I was in the wrong place. And I also had a truck that didn't work. It had broken down. So we were in terrible shape. And I went over to a guy who was with the U.S. Special Forces, an advisor to the Saudis. And I said, "Oh, I got to get to Kuwait City. You got to help me out here. What can I do?" And he said, "Well, you can stay with us. I believe we'll get there about August, the way we're going." The Saudis were not moving fast. They stopped, they'd have tea, they'd pray. He said, "Or you can just cut across there. That's a shortcut, but I believe the landmines will get you. Or you can go all the way back into Saudi Arabia and take a left turn and go all the way back on the east side," which is what we wound up ultimately doing, going into a little town. I begged, borrowed, and stealed a truck there from a guy who ran a baby products store. I promised him my firstborn, my producer, anything he wanted, and then just made a screaming run at about 100 miles an hour for several hours to try to get into Kuwait City when we finally got there.
Who did the driving?
Well, there was a convoy. There were four trucks, but I drove one of them. I drove the lead truck.
Mm-hmm. So you're good at driving 100 miles an hour?
When I've got Rune Arledge back in the United States. Yes, I do. Rune Arledge is the president of ABC News, and he's much more terrifying than the Kuwaitis.
So did you expect did you expect to get to Kuwait ahead of the American troops, or was that just luck that you beat them?
When I started out for the run, it didn't make any difference. I just had to get to Kuwait City, and I had gotten a pass from the head of the Arab forces, a piece of paper saying that I could have my satellite dish, which meant I was unarrestable by the Americans. They couldn't pick me up. I was traveling with a free ride. So if the war had lasted longer, I would have been able to just roam anywhere that I wanted to. And I got to a certain point, and somebody or other told me that CBS had already gotten there and was reporting, and then an hour and a half, 2 hours later, I got there and started reporting, and the luck of it was that we got to the Kuwaiti resistance first.
Mm-hmm. Who gave you permission to have a satellite dish?
Khalid bin Sultan, who was General Schwarzkopf's counterpart with the Saudis. You may remember that there was the Arab force and the American force, and there was some back and forth about who has control and so on. Ultimately, of course, the Americans did, but not if you asked General Khalid. And frozen out by the Americans, I began to develop relationships on the Arab side. And he just came to trust me and said, "Okay, take a satellite dish out and do some reporting. Have fun."
So when you got to Kuwait, what were the first things you wanted to show Americans?
First things I wanted to know were, what's happening to the Kuwaiti people? How many Iraqis are still in town? Who's in control of this city? What are you doing for food? And those kinds of immediate questions. After it began to be settled that the Iraqis had either fled or were being picked up by the Kuwaiti resistance, and the Americans and the Arab forces were beginning to move in, I think a day and a half, 2 days later after I'd gotten there, the next questions were, what happened here? And I began moving toward the issue of atrocities.
Mm-hmm.
And ran into one wonderful doctor who had risked his life with a little tiny camera that he kept hidden in his hospital. And whenever a victim of atrocity was brought in, he and two other doctors would smuggle his camera out, snap a photo at the risk of his life, at the risk of torture, and then try to hide the camera somewhere back in the hospital. And this went on the whole time of the occupation, and he came to me and he said, I've got this film. Can you develop it for me?" And I took it to, I believe, Associated Press. And I said, "Really important film, guys. Can you develop it?" They did. And it was all fogged.
Mm.
all the film was bad, and so he had risked his life finally for naught, and he just broke down and cried. But those kinds of things, it was just one thing after another of seeing what the city had gone through. And then, quite frankly, I saw the horror of watching the Kuwaiti resistance, whom I had come to admire very much, being pushed aside by the government that had been living in Taif in Saudi Arabia at a five-star hotel and came frolicking back into town and just disregarded the Kuwaiti resistance, the ones who had kept people alive and fed and with contacts to the outside world with their own satellite phones, just pushed them aside and took back over again. And now Kuwait is as it was before, which is not such a pretty place.
Right. My guest is Farah Sawyer, and he's anchoring a new news magazine for ABC called Day One. It begins this Sunday. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Farah Sawyer is my guest, if you're just joining us. I'm interested in finding out a little bit about your own background. I know your father was a career naval officer. Did you grow up on military bases?
In my younger years, lived in Jacksonville when he was at the Jacksonville Naval Air Station. However, when I was about 8 years old, he had finished up his 20 years and decided he would like to go to my mother's parents' farm in Central Florida and be a farmer, because he would be on his own then and wouldn't have any bosses like he'd had in the military all that time. And knew nothing about farming, unfortunately. We became known as the single most unsuccessful farming family in Polk County's history. There's a plaque to us somewhere in the town.
Did you like living on a farm? Did you find it boring, exciting?
It was my mother and father and my brother and me, and I truly hated it. We really were the most unsuccessful farming family in Polk County. That's not a joke. But we would put up fences to keep our Angus cattle in, and they would just walk through the fence. they would laugh at us on the other side.
So what were your passions in your younger years?
Trying to avoid hoeing the orange trees. I got really good at hiding in various places and kind of doing a low crawl to my room. Sports and girls once I hit puberty.
Mm-hmm. Now, I read that you were a class president in high school. Did you ever want to be a politician?
No, not after having been class president. That was bad enough. More importantly, I was a disc jockey in high school, in my junior and senior years, which is a far better thing than to be a class president, which is kind of a nerdy thing. Being a disc jockey at, handling the 10 o'clock shift on a Friday or a Saturday night is extremely cool when you're in high school.
Okay, now in college you majored in Eastern philosophy and world religion.
Now it's turning ugly today.
But you and I know that the people who are the real career achievers do not major in Eastern philosophy and world religion.
I know. I don't know. I was heading toward the monastery and took a wrong turn, and I'm here now.
You weren't really heading toward the monastery, were you?
No, I was just interested in how other cultures thought. This is the 60s, and I was wandering around and occasionally going to the anti-war rally and wondering what the heck was going on here. And I was really interested in Buddhism and Hinduism, and particularly interested in Mahatma Gandhi.
It does seem like an odd choice for somebody who ended up in such a high-pressure profession.
I guess, but, it allows me to remain calm in the center of the story.
Right. And then you were going for a doctorate in wildlife management. So
see,
how did you end up in TV?
Isn't this just incredibly silly? I don't know. I just, everything went blank. The truth is that I had been broadcasting for a long time. I'd put myself through college in radio.
Oh.
And I was a sort of journeyman radio type whenever I needed to be. I loved going to study various things. I studied all kinds of things. And whenever I needed money, I could just get a job in radio.
News radio, rock and roll radio?
All the above. I got into journalism at a certain point and probably didn't go back.
So how did you get from radio to TV?
I did a lot more interviews than you do in a single day. I did 8 per day, live. And was just getting blind from trying to do all that studying and know what was going on. Mm-hmm. And I was a little bored from the constant rotation of things. And so I decided to do a Sunday talk show or something on the local stations. You know how horrible they often are? It's just terrible. They're sitting around in uncomfortable chairs talking about city taxes. And I said, you can do better than this. And they gave me an audition, and instead they offered me the 11 o'clock anchor job. Now, had I known what I was getting into, maybe I would have gone to the monastery instead, but it ultimately worked out. It's just hard to figure out television. It's weird.
Your new program begins this Sunday. A trivial point, but is this the first of the news magazines that has one anchor instead of two?
No. 48 Hours has Dan Rather.
True, okay.
Street Stories has Ed Bradley.
Right.
And
true
is that
enough.
It?
That's true
it,
enough.
I think.
Okay. Because usually it's, you know, girl host, boy host kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe they're running out of people now. It's everybody used to have their 15 minutes of fame. It's now everybody will have 15 minutes of news magazine.
That's good. That's
yeah,
good.
It's true. It's awful. You know how these competitive these stories are? They're just unbelievable out there. Because everybody has to get the story exclusively.
Right.
You know,
right.
If Dateline gets the story, we're not going to do it. And if we get the story, Prime Time's not going to do it. So we're all swarming these stories, trying to talk sources into letting us do the story and give us the access that we want. So when you go to sources now, you have to take a number, like at a deli, and wait to talk to them. We're offering a set of dishes to anybody who will actually let us do the story.
But this must be so frustrating for you, because you were telling us how you really like being an independent reporter on a story in Kuwait, breaking away from the pool and everything. And it's in a way like being in a different kind of pool when you're after a lot of the same stories that the other networks are after, and you're bidding for the right to the story and for exclusivity and so on.
It's tricky. It's tricky. The big stories are like that. The trick is to be creative enough to take a bit of a different tack and go wandering off in fields that haven't been tilled too much. I mean, I think we're the first, you know, news magazine's actually going to have a regular agricultural report. For instance, that's a joke too. No, you can watch. It's all right. There will not be an agricultural report, I swear.
Well, I thought maybe this would be your ode to farming,
yeah,
waxing nostalgic for those early days of hoeing the orange trees.
The lost family farm.
Well, good luck with the show. Thanks so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, Terry.
Forrest Sawyer, he anchors the ABC News magazine Day One. It premieres Sunday evening. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.